It's good to see you out, especially on an evening like this, when you had a perfectly good excuse. Some of our visitors came from great distances. We're glad to see you, though. Glad to see you here. We had an exciting day yesterday with this precious soul being restored. Had a good potluck. If I could just get something else to eat. Somebody keeps putting these smaller soups into my closet over at the place that you arranged. Dear people here, you have a sweet spirit about you. The average age of the great world civilizations has been about 300 years. And I'll let you do the math. These nations have progressed through a following sequence, and this has been documented. They progress through bondage to spiritual faith. They have to have something to hang their hat on. From spiritual faith to great courage, and from great courage to liberty. Then they go from that liberty to abundance, and from abundance to selfishness. I've got mine. I hope the rest of the people get theirs. From selfishness to complacency. And from complacency to apathy. From apathy to dependency. And from dependency, guess where we go? All the way back to bondage. We have somebody else taking care of us. We don't need to do anything. We're dependent on them. I didn't say a government entity. I didn't say an individual. I just said we depended on something. And we go all the way back to bondage. But it's my idea that most of this nation is in the complacency to apathy stage, quickly moving toward dependency. Now, thinking people should be aware during these days of the growth of the Islamic faith. This was a religion that was invented by a man. It was supposedly given to him from the portals of heaven in pure Arabic by Allah. So, how does a Muslim view us? How do we view a Muslim? Why do they hate us? See, we're starting off with the wrong idea in the first place. They don't hate us. They don't hate us at all. They're trying to get to paradise, and you happen to be in the way. I call them homicide bombers, not suicide. They will blow up anybody they have to blow up. They're a bunch of lunatics, the radicals. Now, my question for you that I asked yesterday, and I hope that you've done some thinking on this, is, please be able to tell me, after this is over this evening, what the definition of a devout Muslim is versus a conservative Muslim, an everyday Muslim that we see on the streets of our larger cities. Please tell me the difference in the two. And can one be a devout Muslim by breaking from the tradition that's based in the Quran? Can they? See, what happens a lot is we're intimidated. We honestly think that they know everything between the covers of the Quran. They don't know any more what's between the covers of the Quran than we do what's between the pages of the Bible, all the way from Genesis to the maps. And yet we're intimidated by these people. They're good people. I have so many friends who are Muslim. We have spirited discussions about it. I mentioned this yesterday. I mentioned that my physician, Ishaq Salik, is a devout Muslim. And before our spirited discussions, I mentioned to the group yesterday, I always make certain that he puts away his scalpel and knives. He's a good man. A good man. I converted in my years one Muslim to Christianity, knowing what they have to go through if they have a conversion to anything outside of Islam. I wonder where they are now. The young lady that wrote the foreword for my book out there, Samia Collins, some of the visitors here this evening may have been to one of her ladies' days. She does quite a bit to raise some small children at home. But she was giving me some of the horrifying stories that happened to her. She was growing up a young Christian Pakistani surrounded by her former friends who are Muslim. And then moving over here, and now she's the wife of a gospel preacher in Dalton, Georgia. You see, before September the 11th, 2001, most Americans could not locate on a map the predominantly Islamic countries. If you cared. I used to think that maybe war is God's means of teaching Americans geography. I know where Turkey is. Some of you know where Incheon is. Some of you know where Normandy is. Some of us know where Vietnam is. Some others know about the Persian Gulf and Afghanistan and Iraq. I know exactly where they are. But how in the world did I have to make their definition be contingent on all the things that we see over there? You see, terrorism has been with us for a long time. It didn't start back in the 1990s. It's been with us for a long time. The government, just in 1980, defined what terrorism was. And terrorism will be with us, whether it's the homespun kind from Timothy McVeigh, one of us, and it'll stay with us as long as men find cause to fight against any society they view as oppressive. The September 11th radical group professed to be Muslims. Now, Islam is one of the world's predominant religions, and as of last year, is the largest religion in the world. Most of the present-day terrorists proclaim their undying faith in Islam. And yet they justify their actions by their own interpretation of their religion. We don't have anybody that does that with Christianity, do we? Before we get too religious. In effect, September the 11th marked the day that these Islamic reprobates hijacked their own religion. But then someone asked the question, aren't all religions just about the same? You have to be changed from somebody that's bad to somebody that's good. They profess some type of a god, where he's Odin for the Vikings, or whether he's the Holy Spirit, or the place that you go to, the happy hunting grounds as a Native American. You have to have some place to go, an afterlife, some eternity of bliss. But this missionary religion, as Muslim claims to be, has to start following one of the most fundamental concepts of mission work. It's workers. All those that you see on television, in your personal life, all of those people must assimilate into the society of which they're a part, not the other way around. I don't go into China and expect China to change to Burt's way. They come into our country, they follow our constitution, they learn our language. Give me your tired, your poor. That's fine, as long as they follow that. Your huddled masses yearning to be free. If they follow that, that's fine. That's what we all had to do at one point in our history. Why is it so many of them stand outside our embassy doors begging for visas to come to this country? To a country that allows them to do the things that their own home country won't let them. There are 170 sects of Islam. Their predominant religion in 81 countries is Islam. And we think still that they're just that cute little thing across the ocean. Islam is an urban religion. Muslims have never been shy about moving into a city or a country and immediately engaging the local populace in the joys of Islam. Female genital mutilation, which we'll touch on a little bit tomorrow morning at the ladies' class, but frankly, publicly, I'd rather not get into it. I have one of my workers, Barbara Jones, no relation, that has an excellent ladies' day on Islam and can go into some of those things with us at some point, maybe. But what may look like a very laid-back, informal routine of building a friendship with the person next door may actually be their personal evangelism. They have a term in Arabic called taqiyya, and this means that they will go to great lengths to come very close to you as a friend. It may take a few years. Your children may play on the same little league team. You may be interested in the same things as a hobby. But their ultimate goal is to get you in a position where you like them, where you trust them implicitly, and then they wait until something happens and they can make their move against you. Now, that sounds very cynical, and I'm not a cynical person. I've chosen not to be. I said I've chosen not to be. Most of us, if we have any time at all on this earth, we know just about all the tricks there are. We have chosen to be Christian. Muslims look pretty much like the rest of us. You may see them operating a convenience store. You may see them driving a taxi cab in some of our major cities. You may see them as a physician. You may see them as an entrepreneur in this country. They are not shy about it at all, but there's a passion inside them that doesn't allow for complacency. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. I wish we had their passion. Let me say it again. I wish we, who are Christians, New Testament, all the way, had their passion. They have two ears, two eyes, two legs. But what makes the difference in the way they approach their mission and the way we approach our mission? We in the West are still enamored with the fairy tale version of Islam. Remember the Arabian Nights? Remember On the Road to Baghdad, if you're old enough, with Bob Hope and Bing Crosby? Maybe the flying carpets, belly dancers. That's where they started, over in that part of the world. But Muhammad, the founder of Islam, was consumed with the anxiety and insecurity of early Muslim thought, with hell always appearing much nearer than paradise. Excuse me. People are continually reminded of the wrath of Allah. If you're a Muslim, that comes at you from the time of your birth to the time of your death. The greatest difference between Christianity and Islam is the personal quality of God. I'm not able to touch Allah, to love Allah, to go to Him in prayer. He's just there. And yet I can go to my Father. I can go to Him when things are happy, when things are sad. And so no wonder there's so little security in Islam. You can be one of the most faithful of all believers in Allah and still be rightly sent to hell. You can, on the other hand, be one of the worst people in the world and still go to paradise. Now, you may be hearing these things and think that I have a personal bias toward Islam that's unfair. But we don't have to look any further than the founder of Islam, the originator of Islam, Muhammad, to see the apprehension that this causes. Here's what it says in Hadith, one of his teachings, one of his sayings. By Allah, though I am the apostle of Allah, yet I do not know what Allah will do to me. Well, now that would convert me in a second. Muhammad questioned his own salvation, even though he was the greatest of the prophets, the apostle of Allah himself. But regardless of whether these Muslim extremists convince the American public that Islam is a religion of peace, they've got a bigger problem than this. They haven't been able to convince millions of Muslims that Islam is a religion of peace. It wasn't some Western-educated bigot that wrote, Islam has left a fingerprint of blood through every page of its history. It was written by a former radical Muslim, whatever that is. And that's why I'd like you to give me a definition before I leave. One doctrine of Islam that motivates men to fight in jihad is their view of the link between salvation up there and jihad, holy war. And some people say, yeah, Bert, but that could also just mean an internal struggle, hogwash. You go up to a man on the street in any one of the predominantly Islamic countries, 81 of them, and ask them what jihad is. Oh, that's a holy war. They've left a bloody trail for the 1,600 years of their existence. 1,400 years of their existence. One doctrine of Islam that motivates men to fight in jihad is that the Quran teaches that to die in jihad, dying in homicide bombings, dying against American civilians, assures one of paradise. I can prove it. If you look in Surah 61, chapter 61, verses 11 through 13, "And ye shall believe in Allah and His Apostle and struggle hard in Allah's way with your property and your lives. That's better for you, did you but know. He will forgive you your faults and your cause you to enter into gardens beneath which rivers flow and goodly dwellings in gardens of perpetuity." That's the mighty achievement. "And yet another blessing that you love, help from Allah and a victory near at hand, and give good news to the believers." Their view of paradise is so much more carnal than ours. We're told about a street, not streets, as some songs say, but a street of gold. We're told about all these gates of pearl. That's so our finite mind can understand it. He's letting us know it's going to be a pretty good place. But their view of paradise is so much more carnal than that. They're promised that they will find in paradise virgins neither man nor anything has ever touched. That's Surah 55 and verse 56. I mentioned to a group last week that Muslim percentages, population percentages, dictate their strength. From about 2% up for a few percentage points, they began to recruit from ethnic minorities and other disenfranchised groups and from gangs and people incarcerated. And this is happening in Germany, the United Kingdom, and Spain, and Thailand, where their percentage rates are about 2 to 3%. And then from 5% on, they exercise an unusual, out-of-proportion influence to their percentage of the population. Do you remember in the history books when they had the Warsaw Ghetto, and the Jews were trying to get out of there as quickly as they could? Listen, in our major cities, in the areas where the Muslims are, they're trying to form their own ghettos and keep you out. Even the national police won't go in there. They run it from inside. They go into food stores and ask for a job. They will then ask the management to introduce standards, food standards that are clean by Islamic standards. They call it halal, H-A-L-A-L. And when they're successful in getting food preparation jobs, they will increase pressure on the supermarkets, sometimes to indicate that their food does not come up to Islamic standards, and they have threats with failure to comply. This is occurring in France. Have you noticed anything in Paris lately? Noticed anything in some of these other countries like the Philippines and some of the others that have just a 5% increase? Today there are 170 sects of Islam, but it's fundamental to an understanding to realize that as early as 656 A.D. to 661, divisions had already begun. Nothing's changed. There are still physical battles between so many Islamic countries. The Sunni, the majority group that we were discussing a little earlier outside, the Sunni branch, the majority, had determined that leadership after the death of Muhammad had to be a decision for the community. Now the Shiites, the smaller group, had insisted that leadership after the prophet be entrusted to a member of the prophet's family. And so, therefore, you would have successors that kept it in line all these centuries. And now fast forward the bickering. Fast forward the tribal wars and the endless desire for preeminence, and we end up in the 21st century with still the same tribal system out in some of those deserted areas in Afghanistan and some of the others. The Sunnis and the Shiite beliefs in the same God, a great number of commonalities, both have the same language, both have the same ethnicity, both have the same cuisine and basic clothing. Now, we don't have that in the United States, do we? We don't have a cowboy in West Texas out there with a 10-gallon hat and boots, and then maybe somebody else on Madison Avenue with his Armani suit and Italian custom-made loafers. Before we think too closely about how dumb some of these things are, we need to look at ourselves to see that we have differences. But somehow we find a way. We found a way to exist. Let me say something about the eldership so I can give them their due. They have to find some way in a group of any size to get all these people with these differing opinions, I didn't say doctrine, these differing opinions to be some type of a cohesive unit and keep them from knocking each other's brains out. Whenever you have, let me think, an addition that would involve, a multi-purpose room, for example, maybe an addition to the parking lot, maybe an addition to another part of the building, that's when Satan gets to work. Did you hear what I just said and remember it? That's when Satan gets to work. He will be in there the day that they put that shovel in the ground. And he'll stay with it until that pressure mounts. And you may have some families that leave because they don't like the color of the shovel. Or they may not like the way that this building tilts out that way. What kind of chairs are those for a multi-purpose room? I mean doctrinal stuff. How does a Muslim in the United States see us? That's the topic for discussion tonight, along with why they hate us. They don't. You just got in the way when he was on his way to paradise. You just got in the way down at the marketplace. You got in their way on the bus in Paris when he blew it up. Nothing personal. I hope you understand that. Nothing personal whatsoever. As you read through the book out there, or any other material that you happen to have on Islam, would you please let the elders here know and let them pass the word on to me what a picture of paradise looks like for a woman? I can't find anything. I might find one or two surahs or parts of chapters that mention the female. But I will be totally honest with you, I have no idea why any one of the distaff side, any lady, any woman, will become a part of the Islamic faith. And I've done that with a lot of Muslims in the audience. And they're a good audience. Don't get me wrong. Sometimes I'll go to some of our universities, such as the University of Pennsylvania or Toledo University or the University of Virginia, and we'll have these little get-togethers with people from these Muslim countries. And the only way I knew to do it was to have the audience out there and up here on the platform have two tables lengthwise, diagonally, and have a sign in front that said Muslim. And on this side, I started to put Christian, but we'd get every stripe in the book, so I just put others. And you'd be surprised the intelligent comments that we get. The civilized discussion that we get between the people. We can do it, but I don't think it's going to happen. Don't get depressed. I don't think it's going to happen in our lifetime. I don't think it's going to happen in most of our children's lifetime, this big change. I think it will take the youth from the other countries intertwining their beliefs and customs, and I'm not talking about religion now, I'm talking about interacting one with another and seeing that we're not the great Satan, seeing that we're pretty good. We're the most giving country on the face of the earth. I think that's the way it'll come. But it's going to take a long time to get there. And so many battles in between. One doctrine of Islam that motivates men to fight in jihad teaches that to die in jihad, which would include, according to many Muslims, dying in homicide bombers against a bomb since against American civilians, assures one of paradise, regardless of what else you've done. Here's what the Quran says in Quran 55, 56. Ye shall believe in Allah and His apostle and struggle hard in His way with your property. Their view of paradise is so much more carnal. But as we go along through this, we have to enjoy some of the small battles along the way. There's a young Muslim graduate student in Tampa, Florida, who talked to me when I was down there for a meeting. Had some professors from the University of South Florida, 110% Islamic, who wore their tunics and came every night. Every night. I think I might have mentioned this here. Maybe it was last week. I said, "Why are you here? You're here every night." He said, "We like your cookies." But they were a good audience. We had a great time together. I knew we would never, never agree with their doctrine. Neither they would agree with ours. But this young Muslim graduate student wrote to say that she is starting a study group after our meeting to study the Bible and compare it with what she had followed most of her life, the Quran. And I assured her that the Bible can stand the test, but that she needed to study with a gospel preacher, an elder, someone who is very, very educated, very serious about their study of the Bible. One Muslim in Washington, D.C. reported that her comfortable certainties about Islam had been shaken. She said, Brother Bert, "I've been studying the Bible, but I can't admit it to my friends or they would literally stone me." An American Muslim in the Dearborn section of Michigan, where I held a meeting, right smack in the middle of Dearborn, working in an Islamic study center, he committed himself to discreetly distribute our book. I said, "You don't need to do that." He said, "I'm not going to do it here." But he said, "It's about time that a new generation of Muslims in the West raised their voices against the blind faith that doesn't save a single soul in a nation that gives them a chance to make up their own minds." I was able to witness personally a civilized, enlightened discussion at a student center at one of our major universities. Ohio University. Somebody mentioned to me the other night they had been done part of their work at Ohio University. And it was an exchange between dedicated Christians and Muslim exchange students. An elderly Muslim woman shyly approached me in the Baltimore area. She had on her burqa, her hijab, and her eyes always diverted from looking directly at me. She said, with her daughter translating, "With you telling others of my religion, I finally see the possibility in my lifetime of the truth being told about women in Islam. I've asked questions for most of my life and was looked upon as a child, asking children's questions. I was told Zoba, her name, someday you'll understand," in a condescending manner. You see, the struggle between the West and the radical Islamic forces is not one that will find a compromise situation. It's not about compromise. It's not about just getting along. It's about domination, not cooperation. That's the whole key to their religion. And until they can make certain that you are the subservient religion, we're called people of the book. That's going all the way back to when they studied the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. They got tired, we'll cover this more tomorrow night, on the skeptical origins of Islam. They got tired of the colonialism. They said, "We need our own religion." They got tired of the other. But part of their doctrine was, until you pay a tax, a zakat, until you pay a tax to somebody — I'm still trying to tell who we pay our tax to so we can go ahead and have Christianity — and declare them the superior religion, the Jews and the Christians are called people of the book. They'll leave us alone, and they'll let us do our little work. And that's fully the way they understand it, and a serious note. And until they dominate the United States, they can't move on to another country and try to dominate it and then dominate another one. That's the way they've faced it from here on out. I mentioned to you that the British legislature had okayed Islamic law to be carried out in domestic and civil cases for their Muslim neighbors. Oh, that's also happened in Australia, part of it. It's also happened in Sweden. It's also happened in Denmark. It's happening in one or two other countries that are not that way yet. We have to be polite. And if we're too polite, all of a sudden, you won't have any control anymore. We have two members of Congress now who are Muslim. And they said if we work the way our plan should work, along with the Muslim Brotherhood, by 2040, we'll have a Muslim in the White House. Don't say a word about it. Say this, the Quran says, when you slay an enemy. So you did not slay them, but it was Allah who slew them, and you did not smite when you smote the enemy, but it was Allah who smote, that he might confer upon the believers a good gift from himself. Surely Allah is hearing and knowing. Wherever we live, we have to stop the rising tide of Islamofascism. We have to understand who this enemy is. We have to understand how he thinks, how he operates, how he exploits our weaknesses, which is an absolute satiation of entertainment. We're an entertainment nation. Look at even the commercials. The commercials show everything that has to do with play and beauty and so many other things. We're satiated with entertainment and will be. We have to use every legitimate means at our disposal to fight back. And it has to be done just as the Muslim Brotherhood did at theirs. It has to start at the grassroots level. And we have to say enough to political correctness. Just as we did when we had undocumented aliens. What was the other name for them? But we got up to the point where we had to say undocumented. I think they're illegal. And when necessary, we have to insist that our government used armed forces so that we can win this war. They have to be stopped. I conduct this meeting I mentioned to you earlier in Dearborn. I went back home that night, and I watched a television news program. The man being interviewed was an Iraqi. He told of an Iraq that he knew as a boy, an Iraq before Saddam and the Taliban. He said, thanks to my adopted country, America, it's time for me to return to the land of my fathers. It's time for me to go home and to begin to wipe the tears from the eyes of the orphans. It's a time for democracy in a land dominated until recently by warlords with absolute power and ancient barbaric rituals. Not democracy American style, but democracy where every soul is treated fairly according to our Muslim culture and where the respect for our ancestors is still honored. Brethren, we need to go a long way to even begin to put up any resistance against this religion. Why do they hate us? Why do they hate Christianity? Why do they hate Judaism and all these? We're told that we have the most powerful military in the world. We're told that we will face no serious threat for some time to come. And we're given reassurances aimed at deflecting any serious discussion of national security that Islam is a religion of peace. Number one, this is telling us that we will never go to war with China because our economic interests are intertwined. That America won the Cold War, Russia is no longer our enemy. Why should we be concerned over something called jihad? And until recently, we could say that we had an ocean between us and the Middle East. But we know better than that now. Tomorrow night, I want to get into the skeptical origins of Islam. This is the meatiest part of our workshop this week. The skeptical beginnings of the religion of Islam. Things that you can write down, things you can discuss in a civil way with these people who were made in the image of God just as we were. And they need to see the light of His gospel. Don't get mad at them, but bring them to Christ. That's what we need to be intent on doing. There's someone standing at the door tonight. There's someone standing at the door waiting for you to open it. And he will continue to knock as long as you're on this earth. Patiently. Waiting to have you open the door and invite him in, and he will sup with you and you with him. Some of you will live your entire life and die and never open the door. That is so sad. Because he put a soul in you in the womb of your mother. All he's asking for is that soul back. Is that too much to ask? Every page I see on the Bible, in the Bible, every page I see, he's inviting us to live at his house. I think one or two times I've noticed where Satan invites us to his, when Jesus was on the pinnacle. And maybe one other place, but who do we follow? If you have two things to do, one for you and one for God, what do you do first? I've fallen short. I've fallen very short. I try, well, sometimes. But that's why we need each other to strengthen each other. That's why we need to, God forbid, be here for worship services when the doors open. If you are a penitent soul this evening, if you've been thinking about doing what that soul did yesterday, if you've been thinking about how you want to spend the balance of your days here and be assured of heaven, that's not an arrogant statement. We're told that heaven can be our home and we can know it in the book of John. If you need to be baptized, the garments are here. If you need to come back to a group of people that love you very, very much, if you want to be a good example of those who follow you, think about that as we stand to sing this invitation hymn. Won't you do that, please?